Okay, Shabbat Shalom, and welcome to United Israel World Union. This is our Sabbath morning Bible study. It's good to be here with you today. It's good to have Dave and Sherry back. They were in a winter wonderland for a week, so it's always good to see your smiling faces. We have been working through the Bible, the first book of the Bible, the book of Genesis, the book of beginnings, according to the ancient triennial cycle of readings. And today, after more than 1 year, we conclude the book of Genesis. So the title for today's class, and I don't always have a title going into the class, but today's class, it was pretty easy. I've called it The End of Beginnings. The End of Beginnings. Some of you will think of a certain prophetic text that has something to do with that. Some of you might want to put that in the comments. Let's see who's sharp on their prophets. The End of Beginnings. Because this marks the end of the Bible's first book, which is called Bereshit, which means in beginnings or in getting started or something along those lines. But perhaps even more significantly, according to the unfolding narrative, it marks the end of the patriarchal period. By the end of Genesis, by the end of the book of Bereshit, in the reading material that we have today, we're going to cover not only the death of Jacob, but the death of Joseph. So I want to begin, if you would, go with me to Genesis chapter 49. And I'm jumping right in this morning. Not a lot of fluff, not a lot of announcements, because I have quite a bit to cover today. So if you'll go with me to Genesis chapter 49, and I just want to pick up a couple of passages, verse 33. Now, you will recall that last week we had Jacob blessing Joseph's sons, Ephraim and Manasseh. We talked about that. So this week, the verse that I'm fixing to read, the verse that I'm about to read, is after he has done the blessing over the other sons. And it says in verse 33, chapter 49, "And when Jacob made an end of commanding his sons, he gathered up his feet into the bed and expired and was gathered to his people." I love the way the Hebrew Bible talks about death. Because this idea of being gathered to one's people is quite moving to me. I've always thought that that's the way to say it, gathered to one's people. Now, it doesn't really talk in the Hebrew Bible too much about what does that mean? What does that look like? What is it to really be gathered to one's people? What does that mean? Now, I also want you to look at chapter 50 and verse 26. It says, "So Joseph died, being 110 years old, and they embalmed him, and he was put in a coffin in Mitzrayim in Egypt." The Hebrew Bible, especially here in the book of Genesis, ends on a very interesting note. After everything that we've been through, after everything that we've covered, the patriarchal narratives and all the excitement, it ends with Joseph and Jacob dead. In fact, the book of Genesis, very clearly, as you just heard me read, it ends with Joseph embalmed in a casket in Egypt. Now, one of the things that I'm going to do both today and going forward is reveal some things from the prophets about these patriarchal narratives and how they hint to, allude to, and even very interestingly enough, they make very clear reference to these stories as relates the prophetic unfolding. Let's go ahead and look, by the way, at Exodus chapter 1. Let's just show you how the book of Exodus begins. In Exodus chapter 1, I want to look at verse 6 and 7. Exodus 1, 6 and 7 says the following, "And Joseph died, and all his brethren, and all that generation. And the children of Israel were fruitful, and increased abundantly, and multiplied, and grew exceedingly mighty, and the land was filled with them." Now, in this particular reading that we're going to cover today, Genesis chapter 49 and Genesis chapter 50, if we take an overview, if I describe to you what the content is, you're going to basically see the following over these two chapters. We're going to talk about what is generally referred to as the blessing of Jacob. The blessing of Jacob. Sometimes in your Bible, it will show in bold print above chapter 49, the blessing of Jacob over his sons or whatever. But we're going to talk about that. We're going to talk about where and to whom the word blessing is used. Because some of these sons, the word that's given to them or the pronouncement that's given to them or about them, as the case might be, is not really a blessing, but it is quite interesting what we're going to cover today. So we're going to cover that, the blessing of Jacob, we'll just tentatively call it that, the burial of Jacob and the subsequent events. In other words, what happens after Jacob is buried? You'll recall that the brothers are a little bit concerned after daddy's gone as to how things are going to go with Joseph. Because remember, things didn't start out on the great foot when Joseph was 17 years old checking on his brothers. And so we're going to talk a little bit about that. We're going to talk not only about what concerned the brothers, but about Joseph's meeting that concern. In other words, what did he say to them? What was his response when they expressed concern about how they would be treated now that the father is gone? And then finally, this reading covers the death of Joseph. In Genesis chapter 49, the question that I want to begin with is, should we think of this particular passage, Genesis 49, as the blessing of Jacob or the blessing of the sons of Israel? Is that what we should think about this as? Or should we pay close attention and see, is there something else that we could call this chapter? And I think there is. One of the scholars that I read this week in the Anchor Bible series on the book of Genesis made the statement that this could more accurately be called the Testament of Jacob. I kind of like that. Now, I do want you to go to Genesis chapter 49, and I will show you why we would call this the blessing. If you go to Genesis chapter 49 and verse 28, this is after Jacob has pronounced a word over his sons. It says, all these are the 12 tribes of Israel, and this is that which their father spoke to them and blessed them. Everyone, according to his blessing, he blessed them. And then it goes on, and he charged them or commanded them and said to them, I'm going to be gathered to my people. So you could look at this and you could say, well, there it is. It's in the Bible, therefore it is the blessing of Jacob over his sons, and he gives each of them a blessing. But I think that the thing that I want to point out is that when we think of blessing, we're not going to think of some of these as blessings, really. All right? The only time, in fact, that the word blessing, and I think this is important, occurs in this particular chapter. In other words, he goes through all of the sons, but the only one that has the word blessing in it is, anybody want to guess? Joseph. Only Joseph. Now, if you read through these, check me, you will not find the word blessing spelled out in any of the sons except Joseph, and there you'll find it several times. So many people, when they study this particular chapter, when they study this particular part of Genesis, and they look at, quote-unquote, the blessings over the sons of Israel, they take this passage alongside two other passages which deal with mentioning blessing of the tribes. And those two other chapters we're not going to go through today. Deuteronomy chapter 33, which is Moses' blessing, and there it is called a blessing very clearly, and Judges chapter 5. Now, a lot of times I've even seen, and I've made these, where you take a chart and you list out the sons and what Jacob said about them and what Moses said about them and what Deborah said about them, and you compare. And there are some differences. So, for instance, by the time you get to Deuteronomy 33, Simeon is not even mentioned. Now, that's interesting. Just left out altogether. In Jacob's words concerning Levi, it's a very negative thing. Very negative. But by the time you get to Deuteronomy 33, for instance, Levi is praised. So there are some differences, and some would say, well, it's just a matter of the timing and the unfolding of the history of the people of Israel and so forth. But nonetheless, that is an interesting study, and I think that you can get some valuable information. But I propose to you today that Genesis chapter 49 stands out in a way that these other texts don't. And in my opinion, Genesis 49 is more important, therefore, for certain reasons that I will set out to make you see over the course of the next particular, the next, say, 45 minutes to an hour. Okay, so the first thing I want to do today is I want to read to you from the Transparent English Bible, and I posted on our United Israel Study Group chapters 49 and 50, but I'm only going to read chapter 49, and then I'm going to teach primarily from that particular passage. So if you go with me to the Transparent English Bible, if you have that, if you don't, please understand that this is just very literal and you use your own translation. All right, here we go. Chapter 49, and Jacob called towards his son and said, "Be gathered, and let me tell to you what will meet you in the end of days." If I were underlining, I would underline that perhaps. "Gather and hear, O sons of Jacob, and hearken toward Israel your father. Reuben, you are my firstborn, my might in the beginning of my vigor, a remainder of lifting and a remainder of power. Boiling over like water, you will not cause remaining, for you went up upon the lying place of your father, and then you polluted. Upon my bed he went up. Simeon and Levi are brothers. Their swords are items of violence. In their secret, let not my life breath come. In their assembly, let not my weight be united. For in their flared nose they killed a man, and in their pleasure they hamstrung an ox. Cursed be their flared nose, for it is powerful, and their wrath, for it is hard. I will divide them in Jacob and scatter them in Israel. Judah, your brothers will cause praise. Your hand will be on the neck of your hostile ones. Sons of your father will bow themselves down to you. A whelp of a lion is Judah. From tearing, my son, you have gone up. He bows, he crouches as a lion, and as a lioness, who causes him to rise? The rod will not turn aside from Judah, nor the prescriber's staff from between his feet until Shiloh comes, and to him will be obedience of the peoples. He binds to the vine his foal and to the choice tendril, the son of his female donkey. He washes in wine his garments, and in the blood of grapes his robe, duller eyes from wine and whiter teeth from milk. Zebulun will dwell at the shore of the sea, and he will be at the shore of ships, and his side will be upon Sidon. Issachar is a donkey of bone, lying down between the ash heaps, and he saw a resting place that was good, and the land that it was pleasant. He stretched out his shoulder to bear, and he became a forced laborer of one serving. Dan will judge his people as one of the tribes of Israel. Dan will be a snake upon the way, an adder upon the path, that bites the heel of the horse, and his mounted one falls back. For your rescue I'll wait, O Jehovah. Gad, a raiding troop, will raid him, and he will raid at the heel. From Asher, his bread will be fat, and he will give dainties of a king. Naphtali, a doe being sent, the one giving sayings of pleasantness. A son of fruit-bearing is Joseph. A son of fruit-bearing upon a spring. Daughters march forth upon a wall. They were bitter to him and shot and resented him, the lords of the arrows. And his bow sat in enduring strength, and supple are the arms of his hands, from the hands of the mighty one of Jacob. From there is one pasturing, a stone of Israel, from El of your father, and the one who helps you, and Shaddai, and the one who blesses you. Blessings of sky from upon, blessings of deep lying under, blessings of breast and womb. The blessings of your father are strong upon the blessings of the ones conceiving me until the boundary of the heights age lasting. May they be to the head of Joseph and to the crown of the head of the one separated from his brethren. Benjamin is a ravenous wolf. In the morning he eats the prey, and in the evening he divides spoil. All these are the 2 and 10 tribes of Israel, and this is what their father said to them, and he blessed them. He blessed them, a man according to his blessing, he blessed them. And I'm going to stop reading there. And this is the portion of Scripture that I will be teaching from today, that and most of the prophetic text in the entire Hebrew Bible. Not really, but I will cover quite a bit from the Hebrew Bible today. So I want to go, if you will, I want to begin once again in the book of Genesis at the first of this chapter. I want you to listen closely, and I will read in Genesis chapter 49, verses 1 and 2. And Jacob called to his sons and said, "Gather yourselves together that I may tell you that which shall befall you in the last days. Gather yourselves together and hear, you sons of Jacob, and hearken to Israel your father." Now, this particular passage should give us pause because of the way it's worded. All right, it begins with a command to his sons, and he uses a couple of verbs. Now, you're translations are going to show this variously. It might say be gathered. It might say gathered and assemble. The idea is that Jacob, who is dying at this point, calls to his sons and tells them to gather themselves together. All right? In this particular passage, 2 different Hebrew words are used. Some translations take them exactly the same. In fact, they are very much related. The root word, Aleph Samech Pei, is what the first word is translated as gathered. All right, you know, Asaf. All right, so that's the first one where it says, gather yourselves together. The second one is Kof Beit Sadi. And these 2 different words are often translated by the same English word. But I want to begin by taking you to the prophets because, to my knowledge, there's only 1 other passage in all of the Hebrew Bible which employs both of these words in the same verse as we have here in Genesis chapter 49. And that is in Isaiah chapter 11. Isaiah chapter 11. Now, the reason that this is significant is to be made plain over the course of the class today. So I want you to go with me to Isaiah chapter 11, and let's begin in verse 11. And those of you who've studied with me for a while know that according to the Hebrew text, The chapters, which were added much, much later, don't always coincide with the break in the text. So at verse 11, there's a break. And it begins as this, here we go. "And it shall come to pass in that day that Jehovah shall set his hand again the second time to recover the remnant of his people that shall be left from Ashur, from Egypt, from Patros, from Cush, from Elam, from Shinar, from Hamat, from the islands of the sea. And he shall set up a banner for the nations and shall assemble the outcast of Israel and gather together the dispersed of Judah from the four corners of the earth." Now, the reason that I went here, as I stated, is that according to my study, and again, I always want people to check and see, but from my studies, this is the only passage other than Genesis 49, which uses these two verbs that are translated, gather, assemble. Now, listen again, if you look, this particular translation, verse 12, "And he'll set up a banner, an ensign to the nations and shall assemble." This is the first Hebrew word, "the outcast of Israel and gather together the dispersed of Judah." This particular prophetic passage deals with bringing the sons of Jacob together. Now, what's our Torah portion today about? Bringing the sons of Jacob together. In fact, Jacob calls them and tells them to assemble themselves together. And then it goes into this blessing for each of the sons. Now, what I want to make the connection here is that in Isaiah 11, this is talking about the assembling of the tribes. Notice it says that the Lord will extend his hand again a second time. Now, what does that mean? What does it imply? It implies that there was a first time. Somehow, in order to have a second, you must have had a first. So what he says here, Isaiah makes the point that the redemption is going to involve at least two attempts to recover the remnant of the people. All right, and it describes, notice it goes in, it doesn't just list the Babylonian captivity. It doesn't just list the Assyrian captivity. It mentions specifically all the captivities, but it also mentions the main areas into which the sons of Jacob were scattered. If you look at that closely, notice the remnant that will be left from Ashur, which is Assyria, from Egypt, Patros, Cush, Elam, Shinar, Hamat, the islands of the sea. All right? So this idea is related in that particular passage, both in Genesis 49 as well as Isaiah chapter 11. Now, what we're going to do is we're going to go through quite a few passages from the prophets today talking about the assembling and the gathering of the people of Israel. But one of the main things I want to do today is lay some groundwork for some teachings that will follow that will illuminate this particular passage and this particular idea throughout the Hebrew Bible. Three verbs: gather, assemble, and listen. Now, for what purpose? What purpose, according to in Genesis chapter 49, the purpose is he will tell them what shall befall them in the latter days. Now, a lot of people read right over this. But in Hebrew, this particular phrase, Akarit Hayamim, the days which follow, the final days, some people call it the end of days, but technically, translated from the Hebrew, Akarit Hayamim is the days which follow, all right? Latter days is a good translation. So what we get when we read this first particular, we see that this is telling us, or Jacob is telling us something about the latter days. He's not talking specifically about things which will happen in that day in which he's telling his sons these blessings. He's speaking of another time, which is one of the main reasons I wanted to bring you to Isaiah chapter 11, because I think that Genesis 49 is pointing directly at Isaiah chapter 11, because it too is talking about gathering and assembling the tribes of Israel. Now, I want to pick up this phrase, Akarit Hayamim. It occurs 13 times in Scripture. And because Jacob uses this word or this phrase, I want to give you a feeling about what it is or how it's used in the prophets. Because at face value, at least, if we read Genesis chapter 49 and we take Jacob's words at the value in which they're given, it does at least hint to something prophetic. So I want you to look with me. We're just going to work through these pretty quickly, but go to the book of Numbers, Bamidbar, Numbers chapter 24. We're talking about the usages. I'm not going to do them all, but in the Hebrew Bible, 13 times Akarit Hayamim, the latter days, is used. So if you go to 24, verse 14. And by the way, this is from the words of Bilam, the pagan prophet. You remember, we call him in the South, Balaam. Mm-hmm. Balaam and the donkey. Mm-hmm. Bilam. All right, so if you look at verse 14. And now, behold, I go to my people. Come, therefore, and I will advise you what this people shall do to thy people in the latter days. So you remember the context here is that Bilam and Balak are having this conversation. And Balak had hired Bilam to curse Israel. But he says very clearly many occasions, I can only go with what God tells me to say. And so what he tells Balak here is that I'm going to go to my people and then I'm going to tell you what's going to happen to your people in the latter days. All right. And we're not going to study that out today. Go with me to Deuteronomy chapter 4. Deuteronomy chapter 4. And the verse I want to pick up is verse 30, but I want to begin at the beginning of the white space. So if you go to verse 425, Deuteronomy. When you shall beget children and children's children, and you shall have remained long in the land and shall deal corruptly and make a carved idol, the likeness of anything, and shall do evil in the sight of Jehovah your God, to provoke him to anger, I call heaven and earth to witness against you this day, that you shall utterly perish from off the land into which you go over the Jordan to possess it. You shall not prolong your days upon it, but shall utterly be destroyed, and Jehovah shall scatter you among the nations, and you shall be left few in number among the nations where Jehovah shall lead you. And there you shall serve gods, the work of men's hands, wood and stone, which neither see nor hear nor eat nor smell. But if from there you shall seek Jehovah your God, you shall find him if you seek him with all your heart and with all your soul. And when you are in distress and all these things are come upon you in the latter days, if you turn to Jehovah your God and are obedient to his voice, and it goes on and it talks about how he will bring them back. Now, here's the interesting thing. Deuteronomy is spoken by Moses, according to the text, as the children of Israel are preparing to go into the land, right? They're not in the land yet, and he's already telling them that they're going to go astray, and they're going to be scattered throughout all nations. And when they're in those other nations, are they going to be obedient to the Torah? Will they be wearing tzitzit and a kippah? And scattered among the nations, will they refuse to eat unclean foods? No. What we learn from the prophets is that history obliged to these prophecies. They were told, you're going to be scattered, you're going to serve other gods, you're going to lose your identity, but something's going to happen. And if from there, right, if from there you shall seek Jehovah your God, you shall find him, if you seek for him with all your heart and soul. So it says that distress is coming and so forth, but in the latter days, the children of Israel will seek God. And this is what we're talking about today. Go with me to Deuteronomy chapter 31, verse 21. 31:21 of Deuteronomy. And it shall come to pass when many evils and troubles have befallen them. Talking about the children of Israel. You notice a consistent theme, by the way. That this poem shall testify against them as a witness, for it shall not be forgotten out of the mouth of their seed, for I know their inclination, what they do, even now, before I have brought them into the land which I swore. Let's see, 31:21. Looking for the phrase, I might have written down. It's in this particular chapter. I evidently have missed the phrase Akarit Hayamim. Let me pull this up real quick. Okay. I won't hold us. Deuteronomy 31:29. I apologize. I had it marked to begin there. Look at verse 29. For I know that after my death, you will surely become corrupted and turn aside from the way which I have commanded you, and evil will befall you in the latter days, because you will do evil in the sight of Jehovah to provoke him to anger through the work of your hands. Notice once again, in the latter days, the children of Israel are associated with bad times that are tied directly to worshiping idols. Now, I believe that this is something that Israel ought to be really paying attention to. Now, go with me to Isaiah, Isaiah chapter 2. This particular passage in Isaiah 2 is also almost word for word found in Micah chapter 4. So, if you go to Isaiah 2, verse 1. The word that Yeshayahu, Isaiah, the son of Amoz, saw concerning Yehuda and Jerusalem, and it shall come to pass in the last days, the Akarit Hayamim, that the mountain of Jehovah's house shall be established on top of the mountains and shall be exalted above the hills, and all nations shall flow to it. And many people shall go and say, come and let us go up to the mountain of Jehovah, to the house of the God of Jacob. And he will teach us of his ways, and we will walk in his paths. For out of Zion shall go forth Torah and the word of Jehovah from Jerusalem. And he will judge between many nations and shall decide among many people. They shall beat their swords into plowshares, their spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war anymore. Again, this is also in Micah chapter 4. A couple of more passages, if you've got the patience, go with me to Jeremiah chapter 23. We want to establish that when it talks about Akarit Hayamim, it's talking about the latter days. In Jeremiah 23, beginning in verse 19. And here we go. Behold, the storm wind of Jehovah. Fury has gone forth, a whirling tempest. It shall fall upon the head of the wicked. The anger of Jehovah shall not return until he has executed, until he has performed the thoughts of his heart. In the latter days, you will consider it perfectly. I have not sent these prophets, yet they ran. I have not spoken to them, yet they prophesied. But if they had stood in my counsel, when they should have caused my people to hear my words and turn them from their evil way and from the evil of their doings. Jeremiah is talking about a storm that's coming, a fury from Hashem, from Jehovah, because, notice, they've once again gone awry. They've got people running to deliver a message that God didn't give. But notice it says, in the latter days, you will consider it perfectly. Actually, in Hebrew, it's a repetition of the word that means understand. In other words, in the latter days, you will understand it in an understanding way. It's a repetition. It means understanding, you'll understand. It's going to be obvious. Now, Jeremiah says this again. Look at Jeremiah 30. I want to go through a few more of these. Jeremiah 30, beginning in verse 23. Jeremiah 30, verse 23. Again, it's talking about the storm wind. Behold, the storm wind of Jehovah goes out with fury, a sweeping storm. It'll fall with pain upon the head of the wicked. The fierce anger of Jehovah shall not turn back until he has done it, until he's performed the intents of his heart. In the latter days, you shall understand this. At that time, says Jehovah, will I be the God of all the families of the earth, and they shall be, all the families of Israel, and they shall be my people. Covenant language. I will be their God, and they will be my people. I wanted to begin to show you that in the last two passages, it says that in the latter days you will understand this, which indicates what? That until the latter days, you won't understand it. You get that? So it's like as these things unfold, more and more people will begin to understand. Look at Hosea. Couple of things, not necessarily in my notes, but in Hosea chapter 3, let's see, verse 4. The children of Israel, Hosea chapter 3, verse 4, the children of Israel shall remain for many days, having no king nor prince, nor sacrifice, nor pillar, nor ephod, nor teraphim. Afterward, the children of Israel shall return and seek Jehovah their God and David their king, and shall come trembling to Jehovah and his goodness in the latter days. Now, you'll recall the story of Hosea. Hosea is told to marry a harlot, and he is to have children with this woman, and she keeps running off, and he has to go back and get her. And the reason that this story is, the reason that, Hosea had to live in this life is because God wanted him to understand what he feels like. That just as Hosea's wife would run off and sleep around, so did his wife, Israel, run off and sleep around. But in this particular passage, it's looking towards a time. Now, Hosea is to the northern kingdom of Israel. He's talking to the northern kingdom. And he says very clearly that Israel will be without the priesthood and without the king and without all of these other things. And in the latter days, notice, they're going to return and seek Jehovah their God and David their king. They're going to come trembling. In fact, in another place, Hosea tells us where they're at. He said they're going to come trembling from the west. Well, so, but we'll talk about that in another class. We're going to talk about where are they now. See, the Bible doesn't leave us clueless. I mean, it tells us, but the problem is we don't read the Bible. We don't read it enough. We don't understand because we're not looking. You know, if you don't get it because you don't read it, that's one thing. If you read it and don't get it, which is another situation, that's one thing. Now, Akarit Hayamim indicates, the passages that I read, by the way, if you want to put this in your notes, I won't go there, but if you go to Daniel chapter 10, verse 14, it's another passage that deals with the latter days. That phrase is used. Many other passages deal with the latter days, but that passage mentions it. Now, the point that I want to make is that what Jacob says to his sons when he assembles them together and he's telling them, gather around, assemble yourselves together, and I will tell you what will be happening, what will befall you in the later days. What he's actually telling them is that what I'm about to say to you is for later. Right? Do you follow? And I want you to understand from what I've just read that you will understand it at the right time. Okay? So a lot of people have spent a lot of time working not only in prophecy, but on this particular passage. I've read a lot of books about this. I've read different opinions. And a lot of times people go through and they go, oh, yeah, this is what it means. That's what it means. And they pick and they go through. But the truth is that for the most part, what we are looking at is that these are not going to be fully comprehended until the time is right. Here's a point that I want to get into a little bit now. Why is that? The book which tells us is sealed. The book is sealed. Those who are supposed to understand it don't and or can't. Now, that puts us in a bad place. If this book contains the answer and those who handle it can't or don't understand it, then where does that put us? I think this is a major point. I'm setting the stage, by the way, for classes, which will begin next week. I want you to go with me to Jeremiah chapter 2. Jeremiah 2. Verse 8. Jeremiah 2, verse 8. The priest said not, where is Jehovah? And they that handle the Torah knew me not. The rulers also transgressed against me, and the prophets prophesied by Baal and walked after things that don't profit. Now, I want you to get this passage. This is so important. One of the most key themes, one of the themes that is mentioned more than any other theme in all the Hebrew Bible, is that the teachers, the people who are supposed to know and are supposed to instruct the other people, they don't know. I mean, this is pretty bad. When you read this, the priests aren't even looking for God. Those who are religious leaders didn't say, where is Jehovah? And the ones who handle the Torah, guess what? They don't even know him. So that's pretty bad. I mean, this says we're in a bad place. Now, go with me to Isaiah chapter 6. Isaiah 6. And verse 9. Now, you'll recall in this particular story, beginning in verse 1, it begins, I'm not going to read it, but it's in the year that King Uzziah died, and Isaiah has a vision, and he sees inside the throne room, right? And he sees these beings, these seraphim, are flying around. A seraph means to burn. These are the attendants of the altar. And Isaiah feels out of place, obviously, and he says, I'm a man of unclean lips, and I live among a people unclean. And one of these beings, the seraphim, a seraph, takes a coal from the altar and touches his lips, and he sends him forth. Now, look at this. Let's see. I heard a voice, verse 8. I heard the voice of Jehovah saying, whom shall I send, and who will go for us? And then said I, here am I, send me. And he said, go and tell this people, hear indeed, but understand not. See indeed, but perceive not. Make the heart of this people fat, and make their ears heavy, and smear over their eyes, lest they see with their eyes, and hear with their ears, and understand with their heart, and return, and be healed. You understand that what the prophet is told to do is to go forward with this mission to cause people not to understand, to not perceive. They can't hear with their ears. They can't see with their eyes. This is a very, very strange passage. So Isaiah says, how long? In other words, how long will this last? And he's told, basically, until the cities are wasted without inhabitant and people have been scattered and only a remnant will return. So the purpose of this point that I'm making here is to show you that the prophets would bring up this idea of a blindness, an inability to understand, and more. Look at Isaiah 29. I've got a few more of these to go through to set the stage. If you go to Isaiah 29, let's go to verse 9. Isaiah 29, verse 9. Amaze yourselves and be amazed. Blind yourselves and be blind. Be drunk, but not with wine. Stagger, but not with strong drink. For Jehovah has poured out upon you the spirit of deep sleep. Who did this? Jehovah. And has closed your eyes, the prophets, and covered your heads, the seers. And the vision of all this has become to you as the words of a book that's sealed, which men deliver to one that's learned, saying, read this, I pray you. And he says, I can't, for it's sealed. And the book is delivered to him that is not learned, saying, read this, I pray. And he says, I'm not learned. So again, we read that God has caused blindness to happen to his people. He sent this on them. And you go, why would he do that? I mean, in our culture, in our day, people talk about getting a revival and bringing to light these things, not covering their heads. Why would God want to do this? Well, it goes on to say, Jehovah said, because this people draw near with their mouth and with their lips do honor me, but their heart is far from me. Their fear toward me is as a commandment of men learned by rote. See, the problem is that the people have brought this on themselves. Their fake religiosity, they're relying on the commandments of men and not the teachings of God. They're drawing near with their mouth. They're praising God in song and in their word. But their heart is far from me, he says. Now look at this. Therefore, behold, I will proceed to do a marvelous work among this people, even a marvelous work and a wonder. You know what it is? Ready? The wisdom of their wise men shall perish, and the understanding of their prudent men shall be hid. Now, we think, well, I'll just go to a priest. Remember what we read just a few minutes ago in Jeremiah chapter 2, verse 8? Those who handle the Torah, they don't know God. Why don't they know God? because they've invested in commandments of men. They've not gone to thus saith Jehovah. Go with me to the book of Daniel. Just a couple of passages just so you can pick up the final point on this end. Daniel 11, verse 33. And they who understand among the people shall instruct many. Okay, so the idea here is that there will be some who know. All right, look down at chapter 12, verse 4. But you, Daniel, shut up the words and seal the book until the time of the end. Until the time of the end. What does that tell you? That at the time of the end, these things will be opened. Up until then, not so. But remember, we started with Akarit Hayamim, the end of days, the days which follow, the latter days. At the end, in other words, shut up the words, seal the book until the time of the end, many shall run to and fro, and knowledge shall be increased. Look down at verse 9. I'm just hitting a few high points. And he said, go your way, Daniel, for the words are closed up and sealed till the time of the end. Many shall purify themselves and make themselves white and be tried, but the wicked shall do wickedly, and none of the wicked shall understand, but the wise shall understand. Okay. Now, all of that to say that when we're talking about things related to the eschatos, the end times, the latter days, the day of the Lord. You know, all these passages which clue us in. Jeremiah and Isaiah and many of the prophets will say things like, and in that day. What day? We're talking about this period of the end as things begin to unfold and be revealed. Whenever we talk about the Akarit Hayamim, the latter days, we have many, many clues in Scripture, and some of them are tied directly to the unfolding narrative, such as we've been working through in Genesis, right? So now, go back to Genesis 49, and I'll say this, much of this simply is not understood. I know that there might be people out there who say, well, I know all about it. I understand it. And there may be. But I'm telling you that what follows in Genesis 49 is some of it is just simply not understood, at least to me. Now, others, again, because I think that it's full, first of all, it's full of poetic imagery and obscure allusions. When you read it, some of it is not so easy. Some of it is. But remember in Deuteronomy 29, 29, it says, the secret things belong unto Jehovah, but those things which are revealed belong unto us and to our children forever. Right? Yeah, that's right. In Deuteronomy 29, 29, by the way, let's go there just for a second. And if you're in an English Bible, it's going to be 29, 29. But in Hebrew, it's going to be verse 28. Here we go. The secret things belong to Jehovah our God, but those things which are revealed belong unto us and to our children forever, that we may do all the words of this Torah. Now, right after it talks about the secret things, you know what the next passage says? When all these things happen to you, and when all these things come upon you, the blessing and the curse which I've set before you, and you call them to mind, literally, you return to your heart among all the nations into which God's driven you. So, notice that the secret things and the things revealed are followed immediately with mention of the children of Israel being scattered among the nations. We are talking in Genesis 49 about gathering together the sons of Jacob. That particular passage brings me to Isaiah 11 and all the prophecies about the regathering that we've been talking about. So some matters are secret and sealed, and others are revealed. So whenever we look at this, we're going to have to pay close attention. Some of these things are quite obvious. And one of the things that I want to point out is that what follows in 49 is spoken to these sons of Jacob, which are spoken to as tribes, if you will, the fathers of these tribes. But only three are directly addressed. All right? Nine, they're talked about. Now, you got to pay attention when you read this. Reuven is spoken to. It's almost like if you picture Jacob on his bed or leaning on his staff, as depending on how you translate this, but he looks at Reuven. Remember what he tells him? You, right? He's pretty hard on him. Look at it. Genesis chapter 49. We'll be able to work more quickly through this. 49. And it says, I get to it. And Yaakov called his sons, gather yourself together. I may tell you what will befall you in the latter days. Gather yourselves together and hear, you sons of Jacob, and hearken to Israel your father. It's almost like he looks at Reuven. Reuven, you are my firstborn, my might, and the beginning of my strength, the excellency of dignity, the excellency of power, unstable as water. You. Notice how he directly addresses him. Unstable as water, you shall not excel, because you went up to your father's bed. Then you did defile it. And then he says, he went up on my couch, like he's looking around at the other boys. You see that? It's very, very direct. He's looking, it's like he's talking directly to him. Now, as you work through, you notice that Simeon and Levi, he didn't even address them directly. It's like he can't even look at them because they were bad. Listen to what he says. Shimon and Levi are brothers. Instruments of cruelty are their swords. Let not my soul come into their council, to their assembly. Let not my honor be united, for in their anger they slew a man, and in their self-will they lamed an ox. It's like they slit the tendons of the oxen. These guys are cruel. Now, a lot of people excuse them. Well, you know, they did Hamor, Shechem, and, you know, kind of saw Dinah. And so what do you trick the whole population and you murder them with a sword? Well, Jacob didn't find it excusable at all, and I don't think we should. He basically says, cursed be their anger, for it was fierce, and their wrath, it was cruel. I will divide them in Yaakov and scatter them in Israel. Now, we're going to skip over Judah. I'm not going to cover that. I'll do that in a minute. When you go to Zebulun, Issachar, Dan, Gad, Asher, Naphtali, each of those are spoken about, right? Not at all are they addressed directly. Can you see that? Like if you quickly work through, just to give you a couple of examples, Shimon and Levi, that's one example. If you look at Zebulun, verse 13, Zebulun shall dwell at the shore of the sea, and he shall be a haven for ships, and his border shall be at Sidon. Now, what people say a lot of times, they'll go, oh, yeah, well, we understand that prophecy. Zebulun, you look at a map, we know where he was, and he hit. Okay. But what I'm showing you here is, first of all, that Zebulun is not addressed directly, spoken about. Issachar, a strong ass couching down between the sheepfolds. He saw that rest was good and that land it was pleasant, and he bowed his shoulder to bear. You see that? Dan, verse 16, shall judge his people. Okay. But when we get to Reuven, Judah, and Joseph, they are, in their word that they're given, at least in part, they are spoken directly to. Now, when we look at Reuven's word, it says to me that there's a lesson to be learned here. That what Jacob says is that moral character is greater than hereditary right. Moral character is greater than hereditary right. He's unstable, reckless even. Now, whenever you go to Judges chapter 5, which we're not going to do, it will indicate in some ways that Reuven is indecisive in a particular battle that we're reading about in Judges chapter 5. But because of what Reuven did, I want you to go with me to 1 Chronicles, 1 Chronicles chapter 5. Many of you know this passage, but it's important to read in the context here. Verse 1. 1 Chronicles 5, verse 1. Now the sons of Reuven, the firstborn of Israel, for he was firstborn, but since he defiled his father's bed, his birthright was given to the sons of Joseph, the son of Israel, but not so as to have the birthright attributed to him by genealogy, for Judah prevailed over his brothers, and of him came the chief ruler, though the birthright was Yosef's. Now, this translation sort of softens things up a little bit. But here's what it's saying. Judah has a role. Joseph has a role. But Joseph has the birthright. Joseph has the birthright. And this is very, very important. Now, whether we look at history or prophecy, the working of God's plans and purposes, for the most part, fall to Judah and Joseph. It's not that the other brothers aren't important and that we don't have people from these various tribes that stand out in the biblical story, because we do, but it comes down to Judah and Joseph. When it really comes down to the redemption. Now, if you look at, for instance, Judah in Genesis chapter 49, Genesis 49 and verse 8, this is where the blessing, if you will, of Judah begins. Notice how it begins. Yehuda, you, right? Are he whom your brethren shall praise. Your hand will be on the neck of your enemies. Your father's children shall bow down unto you. Then he switches and begins to talk about Judah in the third person. And then he switches back in verse 9. You are gone up. He stooped down. See the switching back and forth? Now verse 10, the staff shall not depart from Judah, nor scepter from between his feet until Shiloh come and the obedience of the people be his. Now, this particular phrase, by the way, is from the Hebrew, Ad ki yavo Shiloh. Ad ki yavo Shiloh. People don't know what to do with this. I'm telling you that everyone looks at this, and there are many conjectures by many, many able linguists, and there are a lot of differences. Now, here's what we know. Ad ki yavo is not difficult Hebrew. Ad ki yavo. Most of these translations will begin until he comes. All right? I mean, most of them. Like, look at the note in, let's see, I think Tabor includes a few of these. Let's see what the footnote is for verse 10. Okay. The Hebrew text is corrupt here and can be translated several ways. Until he comes to Shiloh, or until he comes to whom it belongs, or so that tribute will come to him. See, the idea of there is an appointed time when something will come to someone. But the particulars are what gives us the problems. Because the difficulty is, like in Tabor's note where it says the Hebrew text is corrupt here, you go, oh, I don't like to hear that. Well, even in the Hebrew Bible, it gives what's called a written for Shiloh, and then there is a to be read. It shows two different words side by side, meaning that the Masoretes, the scribes in antiquity, said, don't read what is written, read what we've recorded here. And so there's a debate. Which one do we take here? Now, the question, as I pointed out, comes down to what is Shiloh? Yes. Right? Now, most people, both Jews and Christians, say that Shiloh is a messianic reference. So either this is one of the main theories, that Ad ki yavo Shiloh means until Shiloh comes. Well, who is Shiloh? Well, Christian would give you a name. Other people might give you a name or whatever, but we don't have anyone later who says, that's me. I'm Shiloh. Or Shiloh. Now, what some people do is they associate Ad ki yavo Shiloh. They associate Shiloh with the tabernacle, right? The place where God first placed his name. So that's one theory. But what I want to do is show you something else, because we could debate what is Shiloh and all that, but here's the interesting thing, that the scepter will not depart from Judah until a lawgiver from between his feet. So the point that I want to make is that there is coming a time, according to this, whatever Ad ki yavo Shiloh means, that scepter will depart from Judah and the lawgiver from between his feet. Now, one of the ways that this is read, Shiloh, it can mean to whom it belongs, basically. Until he comes, to whom it belongs. So we're going to get into some of these things in future classes, I promise you. What I want to do is establish that Judah has a very interesting prophetic word given to him. And among those, it says that the brothers will praise you. Now, in Genesis 29, verse 35, when Judah is named, we see that the name Yehuda is associated with praise. Leah names him praise. We're further told that the sons of Jacob will bow to Judah. Right? I have news for you. That's happening. Mm-hmm. That is happening. Okay? And then further, it says the obedience of the people is to him, is to Judah. So somehow, Judah is one to whom the people will praise and they'll bow and there'll be obedience to Judah. In other words, Judah in some way will rule over the brothers. And we'll see that. as we work through the prophecies. And people might think that that's all good. It might not be all good. We'll have to wait and see. Now, if you look with me at Deuteronomy, by the way, Deuteronomy chapter 33, verse 7. Deuteronomy 33, verse 7. By the way, you can do this with each of the tribes and see what Moses says about them. Verse 7, Deuteronomy 33, this is the blessing of Yehuda, Judah, and he said, hear Jehovah, the voice of Yehuda, and bring him to his people. Let his hands be sufficient for him, and be thou a help to him from his enemies. That's Moses' blessing over Judah. Now remember, Judah is also described as having his on the neck of the enemies, like he's going to be victorious over the enemies. Now, what I'd like to do now is go through quickly the prophecies or the blessing, if you will, of Joseph. Genesis 49, beginning in verse 22. Now, again, the translations here are very, very different. It's very difficult Hebrew. That's why anytime you see where translations vary greatly, it indicates that it's tough. People are having trouble with it. What is it? It's poetry. How do you... All right, so Joseph is a fruitful bough. A fruitful bough by a well whose branches run over the wall. Archers fiercely attacked him, shot at him, hated him. But his bow abode in strength, and the arms of his hands were made supple by the hands of the mighty God of Jacob. From there, from the shepherd, the stone of Israel, by the God of your father. Notice he shifts to directly addressing. Who shall help you, and by the Almighty, who shall bless you with blessings. Notice how many times I say blessing. With blessings of heaven above, blessings of the deep that couches beneath, blessing of the breast and of the womb. The blessings of your father are potent above the blessing of my progenitors to the utmost bound of the everlasting hills. They shall be on the head of Joseph and on the crown of the head that was separated from his brothers. Now, again, only with Joseph is the word blessing used. Only Joseph. You can go look. You say, well, I don't know, maybe it's Judah. Nope. Only Joseph. And the reason I'm stressing this is because people have failed to see Joseph in Scripture. People have failed to identify this group, which I'm going to really make clear in all of the future teachings that we're doing, because it is such a vital part of understanding prophecy. Notice, Joseph is called the one who is separate from his brothers. Now, interestingly enough, in Deuteronomy, in Moses' blessing, he also says this same phrase. Separate from brothers. Now in Hebrew, the word is nazir. You know what a nazir is? It's the word for a Nazirite. A Nazirite is one who I call hyper holy. They take on certain parts of, and it's only a temporary thing. It's not a full let me correct myself. In the case of some, it was a lifelong, right? So you know of Shimshon, Samson is supposed to be a lifelong Nazir. Who else? You know, you can work through some of the text. All right, so the idea, though, is that it is a dedication, a vow that's described in the book of Numbers. But it has to do with the crown. Right? The crown of the head. They're not allowed to cut their hair and so forth during the time of the vow. So I find it interesting that the word which is translated as separate is the word nazir. Joseph is supposed to be this one who is totally dedicated and separate. This is one of the points that I want to make later on. Now, look at Deuteronomy 33. I just want to show you Joseph's blessing in Deuteronomy. Deuteronomy 33, beginning in verse 13. And Joseph, of Joseph he said, blessed of Jehovah be his land for the precious things of heaven, for the dew and for the deep that couches beneath him, for the precious fruits brought forth by the sun and for the precious things put forth by the moon, for the chief things of the ancient mountains and for the precious things of the primordial hills and for the precious things of the earth and its fullness and for the good will of him that dwelled in the bush. I love that phrase. Let the blessing come upon the head of Joseph, upon the top of the head of him who was separated from his brothers. The firstling of his herd, grander is his, and his horns are like the horns of a wild ox. With them he shall push the people together to the ends of the earth, and they are the 10,000s of Ephraim, and they are the thousands of Manasseh. Joseph here associated with his children, Ephraim and Manasseh. But notice, separated, once again, separated from his brother. And I love, again, that phrase, the goodwill of him who is dwelling in the bush. Now, in chapter 50 of Genesis, going rapidly through the end of the reading, Jacob asked permission of Pharaoh to go with the other leaders of the clans, his other brothers. They go to the land of Canaan, to the cave at Machpelah. They bury their father. There's a great mourning. They come back to the land of Egypt, and the brothers are concerned. And what they do, we don't know if they're making this up or not. We don't have a record of Jacob saying what they said he said, but the brothers come to Joseph and they said, hey, you know, before our father passed away, he said to make sure that we told you to forgive us, right? So now he could have said that. But at any rate, they come to him on the authority of their father and say, need you to forgive us all that bad stuff we did to you. Because they're concerned. And they should be. But maybe not, because Joseph responds in something quite interesting. I'll just pick up a couple of these passages in Genesis 50, verse 17. Joseph wept. Let me back it up. The purchase, let me get on the right page. So shall you say to Joseph, this is what they said, the father said, forgive, I pray thee now, the trespass of your brothers and their sin, for they did evil to you, and now we pray you forgive the trespass of the servants of the God of your father. And Joseph wept when they spoke to him, and his brothers even went and fell down before his face, and they said, we're your slaves. And Joseph said to them, fear not, for am I in the place of God? But as for you, you thought evil against me, but God meant it for good, and to bring to pass at this day that much people should be saved alive. And he says, don't worry, I'm going to take care of you. The question they ask, forgive the trespasses of the brothers. Now, a lot of people get all weird and religious on me when I talk about this. Can you forgive sins? Not only can you should. Now, a lot of times people say only God can forgive sins. Not true. Not true. According to Scripture, and we won't go through these, there are plenty of examples where this comes up. A person is supposed to forgive another of their trespasses, right? That's what they ask. Okay, so the answer to that is yes, we can. Do you have to, or will you always? Not necessarily, but just saying. It's biblical. So, in verse 19 that I just read, when it says that he consoled them and spoke on their heart, again, that would bring us to Isaiah if we had more time, because in Isaiah chapter 40, those two words are used. Those two phrases are used to console one and to speak tenderly to the heart. The story ends today with Joseph in a coffin in Egypt. But he said before he died, "Don't leave me here. Don't leave me in Egypt." He makes the command of his sons to bring his bones out when they go. And that's exactly what happens. In the book of Exodus, in Exodus 13, 19, they do indeed, it says, bring the bones out with them when they go into the Holy Land. And in Joshua chapter 24, verse 32, it says that they buried him in a place called Shechem, which he bought, by the way, from Hamor. You remember the story in Genesis. We worked through that. In many ways, the patriarchal narratives foreshadow the events described by the prophets. We've shown examples throughout this study in the book of Genesis. Again, Genesis ends with Joseph dead in a coffin in the land of Egypt, but we're not finished with the story of Joseph. Joseph preserved the life of Israel in Egypt. Perhaps more importantly, even more important than that, is that a descendant of Joseph is the one who brings Israel in to their inheritance. Moses doesn't pass this ruling position to his son, another Levite. It takes an Ephraimite to bring the children of Israel into the land. There's something about those descendants of Rachel. Joseph preserves life. Joshua brings the children of Israel into the land. Genesis ends with Israel's family in Egypt, and the Torah ends with Israel's family outside the line, outside the land, right? So an Ephraimite caused Israel to inherit the land. Why would we think, I'm going to leave you with this thought, why would we think that in the future it would be anywise different than in this story? What if in the future, what if in the latter days, Joseph will be used to sustain his brothers in a time of famine, not of bread and water, but of hearing the words of the Lord? What if, as in the days of old, what if in the Akarit Hayamim, an Ephraimite brings the children of Israel into their final inheritance? I think that would not shock me at all. It's time to move forward. It's time to hear again the words of Jehovah. Beginning next week, something new, something we've not done before in depth. Join us, same time, same Facebook page. Shabbat Shalom.